decider, I am a better man. When I look to leave her, I always stagger back again.
Welcome to Matters of the Mind. Are you looking for answers, ideas, or just want someone to listen to you so you can vent? Join Dr. Peter Sacco as he discusses what matters most, issues that surround the mind. He gets to the heart of the matter when it comes to issues involving anger, depression, addictions, fear, anxiety, relationships, sex, abuse, bullying, and everything concerning you. And now, here's your host, Dr. Peter Sacco.
When she comes to greet me, she is mercy at my feet.
Well, hello there, and how are you all? Welcome to Matters of the Mind. The doc is online. That's Canadian psych doc for you all. I'm Dr. Peter Sacco, and with me always is Todd Miller, my co-host and producer. How are you, Todd?
Doing great today. Excellent, excellent, excellent.
Well, for those tuning in, I got a pretty good show. In fact, I've got an amazing guest today. I have Pat Morgan, who is a great author of a book called The Concrete Killing Fields, which is basically her own story as a homelessness advocate, where she looks at the mistakes, the invaluable community support, and of course, the wonderful redemption for all those who have worked in working with the homeless herself. But you see, what's really interesting about Pat is that by the age of 50 years of age, Pat was named by Time Magazine as one of 20 outstanding college juniors in the United States of America. And she also worked for former President Bill Clinton. And she was appointed to the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. So I thought, since we're doing a show on homelessness and mental health issues surrounding homelessness, I thought she'd be a great person to have on her show.
It sounds like it is. And it'd be really... You know, I've always wondered about the flip side, about getting the word and speaking to somebody that's directly involved in providing services and knowing what goes on in their world, because I have so many questions about it.
Absolutely, Todd. You know what? For those listening, and if you wondered, Pat's coming actually on our show. She's from the States. But here's four really interesting, you know, actually staggering stats. And this is basically yearly. At least 200,000 Canadians experience homelessness in any year. At least 150,000 Canadians a year use a homeless shelter. At least 30,000 Canadians are homeless on any given night, and at least 50,000 Canadians are part of the hidden homelessness on any given night, meaning that they're either spending with friends or relatives, and a lot of times they don't even make the statistics.
That's intriguing that there's that hidden homelessness, because yeah, we all know someone who has a friend or relative sleeping on their couch because of various circumstances, job loss, marriage breakup, and they have to have a place to crash. So that's completely right off my radar in terms of thinking about that as homelessness, but you're right, it is.
You know, what really came across to me, Todd, when I was checking out the CBC News, they actually came out with these stats. They did a special on it. And one of the ones that really floored me, Todd, was that youth between the ages of 16 and 24 account for 20% of all the homeless, with an estimated 25 to 40% of homeless youth, they're either gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, or transgender.
Wow. You did say 16, correct?
Age of 16 to 24.
You know, when I think about my, you know, when I was 16, and a lot of my friends, you know, there were some broken home stories and some, you know, kids that had less than desirable upcomings and upbringings. But man, 16, you're just starting life. You know, you've got your dreams ahead of you. You're still... You know, the homework's still not too much after school. You get to play and just really enjoy life. And to think about being 16 and being homeless, to me, is just, I can't even fathom that, what that would be like.
And you know what, Todd, you bring up a great point. You know, you're a kid. You're basically 16. At that age, you know, I don't know about, you know, today's generation is so different. I think, you know, being blessed, you know, in a wonderful family. At 16, I was involved in sports, you know, school activities. You know, roof over my head, clothes and that kind of stuff, that it's actually hard to relate. And what goes even further, which is even more staggering, is the amount of homeless individuals. And, you know, we're starting at 16 years of age all the way up to 80 years of age, generally speaking, who actually have mental health disorders. And when you throw that in, Todd, it wow, it compounds it.
You know, there's this, you know, I'm familiar with some programs like, I think it's called Out from the Street or In from the Street, where they're helping, you know, homeless people get meals and you know, stay warm. And I keep hearing that for some people, it's a choice to be homeless. It's a conscious decision not to belong to certain rules and conformities of society. But, you know, I don't really know too many people that would want to sleep out in the cold or in a cardboard box. And yes, there's really is a sense of community amongst homeless people, from what I understand from reading various things and watching various documentaries. But you have to wonder if they're just not totally clear on what they're choosing to do, and whether it's a true valid choice or if it's circumstance that's really keeping them there.
You know what? It's a conundrum when you think about it. Like, what is causing this? What is leading to this? I'm looking, you know, one of the stats I see is that as many as 1.5 million of Canadian households, which account for 12 million households, are at risk of becoming homeless any given day. And you wonder, like, is it the economy that's that bad? Is it just the jobs aren't there, the opportunities aren't there? And in fact, this is, having Pat on our show, one of the reasons I'm having her on is because I've had some emails sent into me, and a lot, some of them, I had one that was really kind of interesting, and, you know, this is not a political show, but it kind of raised an issue that, you know, the question was, Peter, why do Canadians donate and send so much money overseas to help other countries when we have this many homeless of our own that have, their generations of parents and grandparents have paid into the system, and now they're the ones on the streets?
Wow, that is a tough one. And I've been thinking a lot about that myself. I think over the years, Canadians have really taken the world stage as the peacekeepers, the people that fly into the desperate situations to offer aid and money and support. But yeah, I think we really need to look at the issues that are going on here as well as helping other countries. I don't think we should stop helping other countries, but I think we really need to look inside and address the homelessness, you know, whether it's a mental health issue, whether it's a hopelessness issue where someone feels, I don't have a future. You know, there's threat of nuclear war. There's no good jobs out there. Whatever it is, with the proper supports and money directed at the situation, I don't know if we can ever truly eradicate it, but we can certainly reduce it.
Absolutely. I believe it's an educational process. I believe that we have to rethink the way that we're doing things. And just two more interesting tidbits of information before we go to commercial break and before we bring Pat Morgan on. This is kind of interesting because we've had shows on this in the past. 7,350 women are staying in violence against women shelters on any given night here in Canada. And 4,464 people per night stay in hospitals, jails, or other interim facilities because they are homeless.
Just to get shelter, is that what the status telling us?
Just to get shelter, Todd, because either they continually get in trouble or they have mental health issues and they're not getting the treatment for it.
You know, if I were homeless and it was a cold night, I'd probably throw a rock through a window or something to get arrested so that I know that at least I've got somewhere warm to stay for the night and possibly a meal.
And you know what, Todd? I think in some people's cases, instances, which is really sad, and it screams, not only speaks, but screams volumes, that their situations have come to that point. And, you know, we live in one of the, I consider being a Canadian, the greatest country in the world. We are one of the wealthiest countries in the world. And, you know, I just cannot believe that the stats are so staggering. This should just not be happening in our country.
Not at all. Well, hopefully Pat will be able to shed some light on some of the inner workings of what's going on in the homeless community.
Yep. And when we return, we will have the esteemed author, Pat Morgan, who has done a lot of community work with the homeless in the United States of America. In fact, she was so well recognized that former great president Bill Clinton had a lot of great things to say about her.
You are, of course, listening to Matters of the Mind. The doc is online. We'll be right back after this short break.
I'm Dr. Peter Andrew Sacco, and do you have technological rage? Oh, yeah. The new rage of anger. Download my new book today, Technological Rage, on my website, www.petersacco.com, and learn what technological rage is and how it is sweeping people today, leading to online dating anger, texting anger, and social online networking forums. Did you ever think you might get angry texting, Facebooking, or online dating? Maybe you never thought it would happen to you, or maybe you know somebody that has this and you just need to understand it a little more. Johnny, show me that you care, really care for me.
Welcome back to Mental Health Matters with your host, Dr. Peter Sacco.
Well, hello there, and welcome back to Matters of the Mind. The doc is online. And before we went to commercial break, we were talking about one of the most disturbing issues that affects Canadians, but not only Canadians. It is just not symptomatic to Canada. It's symptomatic to the United States of America, and it is a worldwide phenomenon. It is called homelessness, and what affects so many people around the world, and where it gets really dicey are when people are not only starving or freezing to death. And anybody living up our neck of the woods here in the Toronto area, Niagara area, knows this was one of the worst winters in Canadian history, that nobody should be on the streets. But when you compound the fact that many of these homeless individuals have mental health disorders or problems, it only makes it worse. And as we said, we have a tremendous, awesome guest I am absolutely thrilled to have, Pat Morgan. And she, 30 years ago, helped break America's cycle of homelessness in Memphis, Tennessee, and across the country. She has a new book called Concrete Killing Fields, which came out February 20th from Mile High Press. And it follows her own story as a homelessness advocate, where she looked at the mistakes, the invaluable community support, and of course, the wonderful redemption of those she has worked with as well as herself. And Pat was also selected by the age of 50, as we said, by Time Magazine as one of the most 20 outstanding college juniors in America. And she worked with former President Bill Clinton. That's a pretty good resume, Pat. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
You're kind of getting into it a little bit about just your neck of the woods in terms of it kind of warming up now. So I guess one of the first questions I just want to ask is, are there a lot of people down your and the area of Memphis and, you know, Tennessee in that area that are out all night because they have nowhere to go?
Most of them are. We have a wonderful emergency shelter that on bitterly cold nights or when it's extremely hot, which happens down here a lot, they just open their doors to any man who wants to come in. Unfortunately, they can't serve the women, so the Salvation Army does the same thing. Still, those who are too sick to come in and refuse to come in, and we don't have any mechanism, we don't have any legal basis for getting them in, are at great risk out there. And one of the things for Memphis is that nationally in the states, 44% of the people who are homeless when we do our annual point in time count are sleeping unsheltered. In Memphis, it's more like less than 10%. So we have a good system here where, you know, a lot of folks don't.
So let me ask you this, Pat. Todd and I were talking about this to start the show, and we've had this, you know, email sent in by listeners that have said, you know what, we live in one of the wealthiest countries, and obviously wealthiest continents, of being North America and the world. And why is there this homelessness, especially when we're shipping money out overseas to help homeless in other countries? Why do we have homeless? Should we not be taking care of our own first?
I think we have a responsibility, both of them. I think we have so much money. This country is so rich in so many ways. I think if we were very careful with our money, I think also the 1% that's making billions every year and not letting it filter down to the people on the lowest rung, you know, I think we desperately need to make some changes there. But we're only as strong as our partners are. You know, if we turn everything and we turn into the perfect example without helping our neighbors, then I think we're missing the boat.
So let me ask you this then, before, you know, we kind of started off a little bit about the homelessness situations and that stuff. What got you into this in the first place, Pat?
I volunteered. I had moved to Memphis. I just moved to Memphis from West Memphis, Arkansas, which is 5 miles and light years away. But I volunteered to help our priest with the people who were coming in off the street. This was the early 80s. The funding for mental health and housing had just been slashed with predictable results. And we were just seeing a flood of people that were coming in for help. And these were people who were living on the streets. I've assessed hundreds, and tried to help them. And I cannot pick out one that didn't have some serious health, mental health, substance abuse issues. It was just endemic. But the first day I volunteered, there were about 10 of them sitting in our great hall of the church, which is a gorgeous facility. And just walking in and seeing those 10 men sitting there, the sickest people I've ever seen in my life, in the midst of our luxurious great hall, I was just hooked. And I think I didn't really realize it at the time, but I had grown up in the 40s and 50s in a very segregated small town in Arkansas. And I was busy having babies during the 60s. I didn't march for civil rights. And I think I felt like I had a debt to pay, because probably 80 to 90% of the people we're seeing were African-American men. And I just felt like I owed it to them. And it wasn't a guilt thing. I just wanted to help. And I was just hooked. And I think, you know, people talk about you found your calling. Well, I found my calling. I lost myself in the basement of that church with all those street people, 50 to 100 on any given day, with staggering levels of disabilities. And I also found myself. I mean, my whole life changed. I could no more stop than I could stop breathing.
I don't really want to get too political, but I'm sensing that when you were in the great hall of the church, was it the opulence of the church, or was it just a feeling that the church was doing relatively well, and yet here were these lost souls that weren't, and that just sort of, was it a contrast that made you want to, it became very clear what you needed to do?
I think that was a major part of it. And the other part was just, I've always been a rescuer. I've, you know, stray dogs, stray cats, birds with broken wings. That's always been who I am. But I had been very political over in Arkansas, and in fact had run and been elected to the county commission, and then we called it quorum court there. But I just saw more about how the system was just so tilted in the wrong way. And that these folks, it wasn't so much the opulence of the church, because it was a historic church. I mean, it's the oldest public building and still in use in Memphis. And it, you know, it wouldn't have done any good to tear it down, you know. But it was the fact that these people, most of them, had never had a chance. They never had a chance. Some of them had grown up during segregation. Others just mental illness, substance abuse, you know. No fathers. If you ask homeless people about their fathers, they look like you're talking about aliens from Mars. So they just really never had a chance. And I think that was it more than anything else. I had a chance. We were very poor, but I had a chance, and I made the most of it. But they just didn't have a chance.
Well, it's nice that you wanted to help them have a chance. But in all your years of doing this, have you ever encountered anyone looking at you like you're an alien, saying, why are you doing this? You know, are you making money from this, or are you crazy? Why are you helping these people? Have you ever gotten that? And what's your reaction been to that?
Believe it or not, I haven't gotten that reaction very often. In fact, people say, what do you do? And I just sort of laugh and I say, I've been working in homelessness for 30 years, and they want to talk about it. Very seldom do I find anybody who just says, oh, I don't know what about this. I mean, they don't knock it. They seem to be very receptive to it. Keep in mind that a lot of people I know are social workers. I mean, I work and live in an area where people have big hearts. But there are some who just think, well, I made it, and then they can too, you know. And then I just explain to them that not everyone is blessed, you know, with have coming from a solid home or with the level of intelligence or with good health and no mental illnesses. And there's no point in getting mad at them. I did that a long time ago. It doesn't do me any good. Those whom the gods would destroy, they first make angry. I was really angry at first because I was angry because the system was not working. And I thought, who is responsible for these folks? Who's responsible for these people who are sleeping in the streets and eating out of garbage cans? And until I found somebody who was, then I thought it was me. And then I found people who were responsible for getting them in, and I still feel responsible.
So, Pat, who would you say then? Because this is going to be probably the most obvious question. I actually had somebody that emailed me this. Who would you say, or what is the major cause in today's day and age for people winding up homeless? Because we have a phenomenon in Toronto up this way here, where you do have individuals of a younger ilk. We were talking about the stats before the show, that a lot of our homeless up here are under 21 years of age. A lot of these are kids. And a lot of them are runaways, or a lot of them are rebels to society, or they just believe they're going to do it their way. What is the typical type of homeless person today there?
You know, we don't have many young people who are homeless in Memphis. The state has a law that if they find a minor on the streets, then they go, you know, after 24 hours, if they can't reunite them with the family, they go into custody for the state if they're under 18. So the kids hide. We know we have homeless youth out there, but we can't find them when we count. They just couch surf and move from one to the other. We know that it's a major problem in Washington State, all along the California coast. It's a major problem. Some of our studies are, I think, a huge amount of it has to do with substance abuse. But there's also we know that a strong percentage, at least 30-40% in the states, have gender orientation issues. Okay, they're dealing with their own sexual identity, and the parents can't handle it, or they run off, they run away, or they're thrown out. We call them throwaway kids. So I think that's a part of it. But I think substance abuse also. We also have the Centers for Disease Control does an annual survey, but Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and the numbers of youth in school who are suffering from depression, have thought about committed suicide, have made a plan, have tried, it's just staggering. I mean, it's 10-20%. So we have all those mental health issues. We have the family breakdown, of course. I mean, 50% of the babies that are born in the United States today are born to single mothers. So we have that. We have the teen pregnancies. We have the school dropouts. So you put all those pieces together. I keep telling people that the fact that a man or a woman, especially, and that would be a youth too, the fact that they don't have a house, an apartment, a room, a job, any transportation, any furniture, nothing but the clothes on their back, and not one single family member or friend who can or will take them in for one more night, okay? None of that is the problem. Why he or she has none of the above is the problem. And unless we deal with those issues, we will never end homelessness. The domestic violence, and more and more, I'm learning, the more I learn about early childhood, those years from 0 to 3, from before the baby's born, the damage that's done to that baby is toxic with domestic violence, with the stress, with the substance abuse. I even did a report. I called it The Elephant in the Living Room, looking at all the ways alcohol, drugs, you know, prescription drugs damage the fetus and how that carries over. Then they have the problems adjusting, which means, of course, then they have problems at school. Then they get thrown out of school or they quit school. And here we go again. So that's our next generation of homeless adults. I never talk about ending homelessness. We will end homelessness when we break the cycle of child abuse and neglect, domestic violence, family violence, substance abuse, all those pieces. That's when we'll end it. And we won't do that until we get the money to do it.
So let me interject with this then, because I brought this statistic up. Todd and I were talking about it at the beginning of the show. A lot of it is tied into youth, teens, and young adults with gay, lesbian, transgender, transsexual, if you want to call them identity crises, or conflict with parents or families. And it seems to be a very prevalent issue. Now, up here, up our neck of the woods here in Canada, I would say, you know, just guesstimating that we're a little more liberal in terms of accepting, and we've had a show on this, you know, the idea of same-sex marriages, relationships, and all this kind of stuff. And there's been a lot of media hate crimes against gay, lesbians, and all that stuff. And you would think that we've come a little further, or a lot farther than, say, we were 20 years ago. And with that said, is it really that bad that that gays, lesbians, especially teens and young adults and youth are not being accepted by families, and they're being ostracized or outcasted that they have to leave?
Yes. I mean, there are wonderful families who are understanding and accepting, okay? And I think it may be about probably 70-30 now, but it's the 30% right now that are in control of our state legislature. So, you know, their mantra is almost guns, gays, and killing babies, you know. I mean, so they're so hard-nosed, they're just totally unbending. If you're not just exactly like them, then there must be something wrong with you. You know, so we've come a long, long way, but our state legislature is still just, you know, hard rock conservative, and it does, and that sort of permeates, you know, the Tea Party is that, you know, is alive and well, I'm afraid, down here, and so we've got our share of problems that we still have to overcome. One of the things I talk about is particularly on the racism side, too. I mean, so we still have got our share of that, but we just had the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, the sesquicentennial. I'm 75 years old. I'm half that old. We're not that far removed from it. So we're still dealing with the vestiges of the slavery and segregation in addition, and nobody is more afraid to acknowledge the homosexuality and lesbianism than the African American community. They've been so discriminated against for so long. You know, it just adds another layer, they think. But so they're much more reluctant to come out of the closet and just be who they are, you know, and be accepted by everybody.
I think
it's an issue. It really is.
And I think, I don't know, if you come from privilege, I've known a few people that have come from privilege, and they are the kind of people that care for others. I'm speaking of one in particular who does nothing but takes the vast majority of his income and disperses it in various charitable foundations and wonderful initiatives. But then there's another segment of the 1% who just really don't have any appreciation of what it is like to struggle financially or through mental health issues. Because let's be honest, you know, having wealth makes life generally less stressful. I mean, you have your stressors, I'm sure, but what do you say to those people that come from that privilege and have no appreciation for the other side of the way things work?
Well, I think I'm pretty lucky. Memphis is regularly listed as one of the most generous cities in the United States. So I don't run into those folks, and I'm certainly not in the level. I don't go to country clubs. I don't even have any interaction with those folks. But I do have interaction with people who say that, you know, capitalism is all we have to do, and it will trickle down. But then I dare them to go out and try to live for 6 months on $7.22 an hour, you know, and make the point, you know, that you've got your billionaires there, and they're still paying minimum wage to the people who clean their toilets. So I make my arguments pretty forcefully with them, and hope it filters up at some point. But, you know, the reality is that the money talks down here, and we've just unleashed unleashed. People can spend as much money as they want to in political campaigns. So if you just flood the airways long enough, you get your people in and they're going to vote the way you want them to. So we have our issues here. But I would, you know, and I'm very much in favor of raising the taxes on them, particularly for the hedge fund people. Why should people who make their money gambling on whether or not this economy is going to sink or swim, why should they get a tax cut? It's gambling.
Legalized gambling.
It's legalized gambling. That's exactly what it is, and yet they don't pay as much taxes or the percentage of taxes as somebody down here who's out here working by the sweat of his brow every day. Now, that's insane.
There's a lot of inequity in the world, and I think I speak from my own experience here in a city of 4 million people where I wouldn't say it's the prevailing attitude, but there's an equal mix of people that are just after the almighty dollar, no matter who gets in their way. And there's a soft underbelly of people that make far less and do far more. And I want to see more of that. And I want to see more of that from people that can generally afford that and have the wherewithal to really make a significant impact in the world by sharing their wealth.
I agree. And I think one of the things we could do, if we just get them out to volunteer one day, if they go out one day and actually see how other people are living, one day in the basement of the church with 50 to 100 homeless people with staggering levels of disability, sometimes is enough to just wake up anybody. I mean, they just live in a different world, and I really believe in humanity. I think people can change. They can. If that, you know, it's the people in the ghettos. All they know is what they see, okay? All they know is what they live in every day. That's the same for the people who live on the upper level. All they see is what they see every day. So they're not really in touch.
Yeah, it's the reality. And when we come back from break, I'm going to share a little story about something that I ran into at a local homeless shelter here. But it looks like we do need to take a quick break. You're listening to, of course, Matters of the Mind on Listen Up Talk Radio at talk-radio.ca. We'll be right back after this short break.
Annoying, frustrating.
Of course you're referring to me.
Some days, enlightening, engaging.
And now you're referring to yourself.
Most days. Just a few of the words employed to describe our show, The Motts. You'll come up with your own.
Hi, we're The Motts, Paul and Carol.
Inviting you to join us weekdays at 2 on Listen Up Talk Radio at talk-radio.ca. And there's an encore performance with Motts Weekend.
You can check us out at themotts.ca. Here's another word for you.
Oh, I wouldn't go there.
You're listening to Mental Health Matters with your host, Dr. Peter Sacco, on RadioThatDoesn'tSuck.com and RTDS.ca.
Welcome back to Matters of the Mind. The doc is online as we look today at something that affects a lot of people, either directly, indirectly, or we read about it, we watch it on TV, we watch it in movies. And oftentimes, a lot of people take the stance that, hey, it's really not my problem. You know, I worked hard to get to where I've gotten to, so why should I worry about the homeless? And, you know, we've got a great guest today, Pat Morgan, who's an author, who's an advocate for homelessness, and who's done tremendous things across the United States, especially in Memphis. And I think one of the greatest lessons in life is that we should never judge, or truly, we're never going to get the book smarts unless we truly walk in another person's shoes to see what it's really like, especially when it comes to homelessness. So with that said, Pat, one of the questions I want to ask you, somebody had emailed me this in, and it really is a kind of cool question, because as a practitioner in addiction studies and psychology, one of the questions I get this asked all the time, so I want to see get your thoughts on it, your takes on it, especially in Memphis. This person wrote in, oftentimes, Pete, when I see these people that are homeless, whether it be in Toronto, Winnipeg, I've seen them in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I've even seen them in the States there, in Detroit, a lot of times they're homeless, but yet they're smoking cigarettes, or they smoke weed, also known as marijuana. First off, where do they get this stuff if they're homeless and they have no money? And the second question that I had from this lady is, was this addictive behavior that got them homeless in the first place, or did they become an addict because they're homeless?
Are you ready?
There we go, Pat. We're ready.
I think it's some of both. I think if you're not, I think but that goes back to my premise that there's something there. You know, two of the first symptoms of substance abuse are trouble at home and trouble at work. Okay? So if you're having trouble at home and trouble at work, or you don't have any work, then that's it. And it's so endemic. I think substance abuse is so endemic across the board everywhere that that's always a major piece of it. And then I'd go back and look at what caused the substance abuse. So it's even deeper than that. Depression, we're just now learning how often the depression is underlying. I mean, that's what causes people to start abusing alcohol or drugs. And as you know, alcohol lifts you for a few minutes or lifts you for a period of time, then turns around, you're drinking a depressant. So then that makes you more depressed. But addiction, you know, there's use, misuse, and abuse, and then addiction. And so I think addiction is really a key part of it. I keep in mind, and here in the States, a lot of the people who are out there who are saying they're homeless are not homeless at all. They're not homeless. So, and I never give cash on the street. As a good friend of mine said, you wouldn't give someone who's suicidal a gun, okay? But what I do is I just tell them that I wish I could, but I always do my homework. I know my homework here. I know where the resources are for homeless people to get help. So I don't give cash on the street. I just tell them I wish I could. And that covers a lot of territory. You don't want to enable them to continue killing themselves with alcohol and drugs, okay? And 90% of the time, that's probably what it's going to be used for. So, yeah, but adults, you know, there are the people who just want to say, oh, every homeless person out there is the victim of a cruel society. But that's not it. Homeless adults are just as capable of making messes with their lives as the rest of us are. They're just as capable of making poor choices. So you don't excuse those, but you do try to ensure that the services and the treatment are there for those who are willing to accept it. And what we're dealing with, and where I'm on my latest tear, is for those people who are mentally ill, are so sick they don't know they're sick, and we cannot get them into treatment. If you're not suicidal or homicidal, basically standing there with the knife or the gun in your hand, we can't get them into treatment. So Dr. Fuller Torrey is the nation's leading advocate on that, and he's coming up with a model plan where we might be able to do that, but it winds up being all about the money. But no, if they're sitting there smoking weed and smoking cigarettes, they don't give them any money. You're probably just contributing to it.
Yeah, he's wrote the book, Criminalizing the Seriously Mentally Ill, the Abuse of Jails as Mental Hospitals, correct?
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, I'm on a total tear about that. One of the things that they have, and this is endemic across the country, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but there are two to three times as many people with mental illnesses in jails and prisons in the United States as there are in mental institutions. There were 600,000 beds when they started deinstitutionalization. Today there are 60,000. And they keep cutting them, and they keep cutting them because there's this war between the feds and the states over who's going to pay for it. So it really comes back down to the money, and then with some, it's just a philosophical thing. Well, the states have always been responsible for it, so they should keep doing it. The problem there is that it's a huge problem, and the states have to balance their budgets. The feds don't. The states can't print money. The feds can. So, you know, it was a matter of choices. But until we change something there to see who's going to pay for it and it actually trip the trigger so we can get the funding for it, it's not going to change. But the jails and prisons, they have these suicide cells all over the country. Here in Memphis, they have what they call the buck-naked cells. Okay, that's a Southern thing for buck-naked. Okay? Now they've changed that to butt-naked because they now have some little gowns that they put over half of them, and they are just obscene. These cells, if you're not mentally ill when you go into those suicide cells, you are shortly thereafter. They're just unbelievable, and that's happening all over the country.
Oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of times people think that Jails are a great place to rehab people, how should we say, rehabilitate them, counseling them, get them the treatment. But, you know, that's the furthest from the truth. But with that said, Pat, I want to get into the concrete killing fields. We know, obviously, what your motivation was for writing this book. How long did it take you to write this book? And can you tell us a little bit about it?
Actually, I wrote it about three times. I wrote it the first time when I first went to Washington, and I was interning in Al Gore's office and temping around town after that because I couldn't find a job. But I was determined to do something with homelessness, and I wrote the stories about all the homeless people that I had worked with, and I did it in a chapter-by-chapter thing. So each chapter had a homeless person and their situation and their story and what we could do about it. Well, that turned out not to be a marketable concept, and actually then what happened is I'd written it, but then I jumped on the Clinton campaign and worked on that and the presidential transition, and then went into the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. So for the 8 years that I was there, I was working, 6 or 7 days a week, 12 to 18 hours. I mean, there was no time to write. So then I messed around with it after I came back home. And then for a number of years, like probably 8 years, and then I retired and turned my total attention to it, to that and getting published. And then I was rewriting it because the more I wrote, the more I realized how profoundly they had affected my life, and it also kind of sent me on my personal journey. I found my mother's grave that after 44 years. I just went on my own personal journey, and I found an enormous amount of healing through that process. And so, they say if you're going to write about yourself, you need to open a vein. Well, I think I hit an artery a couple of times. Because it really sort of came in spurts as I realized that this, the nightmares that I had were directly related to alopecia, my central character, telling me what the voices had said to him. So it was just all a mix, and then it just flowed. But I still had too many characters in it, so then I had to rewrite it to break it down to my main character, alopecia, and some of the, then I called it the concrete killing fields, and I have a chapter on the body count, but I also have the chapter on successes. And then I wrote in there, too, all the parts about, how being on the campaign and the Clinton administration and what we accomplished there but just kept bringing it back. There's a good bit about in there about suicide, too. I've written around one of our homeless people, and I had taken a dagger away from him. I still have that dagger in my dresser drawer. I don't know what to do with it still after 30 years. But then working with him and dealing with him and the book that he had sent to me, we barred him and he couldn't come back in the street ministry for a couple of weeks. And he sent me a book by one of his friends. Well, one of his friends brought the book in. And he had checked it out at the library, and it was The Suicide Club, which was really telling me, he was trying to kill himself the day. And I knew he was, but I had taken this dagger away from him. And so then that really made me, when I read the book, and then that really sent me into looking more into my mother's suicide and the role that I felt that I played in it and the guilt that I'd carried all those years. Because the only time I'd had an opportunity to reconnect with her, I blew it. And we didn't have call. She had called after 10 years. I was 15. We didn't have caller ID. I didn't know where she was. I couldn't find her. I'd planned my whole life to go find her. So it's that litany of losses, and that's what homelessness is about. It's about losses. So people are really, really picking into and seeing into that and looking at their own history of losses. And then that's making them looking at their own history of losses and beginning to deal with it. And I'm finding that pretty much across the board from the people who've read it. They start out with the homeless people, and then they realize that we're not that different.
So what would your main message then be, Pat, or your main goal with this? Is it to get people more empathetic as well as even sympathetic to the needs of the plight of the homeless to make a change? Or is it to make them more aware of, in some cases, that the government could and should be doing more and that people should be speaking out to say something and do something about it?
It's both. And I use the, you know, if you're more, if you begin to think more about them and care more about them, then you're more likely to do something about it. That's when I was talking about if you get somebody to come out and volunteer one day, you know, get them to go out on a street count with you. The cover of that book, of my book, and this is, was not an ego thing because you can't even tell who it is, but that's me, and I'm up under an overpass at 3 a.m. on 3rd Street in Memphis, and those people that rolled up bundles there, those are people sleeping like that. If you can get somebody out to see what it's really like out there, then you've got a much better chance of, you know, talking them into helping you. So I'm hoping that it will not only sensitize but move people to action. I mean, whether it's helping an individual or helping in a program or lobbying for more money to do what we need to do.
So for anybody listening today, Pat, and we probably have a lot of listeners that are wanting to know, where can they find your book? The best place, the most efficient way to get your book in their hands ASAP.
It will be soon in almost any place where they sell books, or you can order it. I have a publicist who's working on getting them, a distributor who's getting them into some of the major bookstores. It's on Amazon.com. It's on Kindle. And we're hoping to have it in bookstores all over America. And I have a good friend in Canada who's been trying to get me started up there, too. So I'm hoping it'll be there, too. But Amazon.com.
Amazon.com. Also, do you have a website for the book or your own personal website that people can look you up?
Yes, it's patmorganauthor.com.
And we will have a blog post later about that with all the amazing links to Amazon and Pat's amazing site.
So before we let you go, Pat, thank you so much for being a tremendous guest. Absolutely, you are making a difference, not only in Memphis, the United States, but in this world. Can you give our audience something to go on in terms of what message would you want them to remember you on the show today in terms of a quest, a vision, or a thought process when it comes to homelessness?
Just keep in mind that that person out there could be your daughter, your son, your mother, your father. It's a human being, and they have had their own litany of losses, and just see them as a human being. Don't think of them as a homeless person or anybody who's any different from us, because they really aren't. And that's, you know, if you'd feel compassion for your sister out there, then you feel it for that woman who's sitting on the corner.
Absolutely. The Concrete Killing Fields by Pat Morgan. Definitely go out, get this. It's one woman's battle to break the cycle of homelessness, and one woman breaking this cycle is not enough. We need thousands to jump on this bandwagon. Thank you so much, Pat, for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Matters of the Mind on Listen Up Talk Radio. We'll be right back after this short break.
Have you ever spent the day mulling over receipts, spreadsheets, and the numbers? It isn't a lot of fun, is it? Especially when you have a business to run, sales to close, and clients to work with. The last thing you want to do is look all day at the books. So get the expert advice and wisdom from a seasoned professional, Bob Conway. At Robert K. Conway CGA, Bob will come and meet with you, analyze the numbers, assess your tax situation, and show you how to put more tax dollars in your pockets than Revenue Canada's. And he'll also provide you with ideas, wisdom, and solutions to help you track your numbers so you can plan properly and strategically and really begin to grow your business. Are you ready to work on and not in your business? Then Bob's not only your uncle, but Bob is your man. Robert K. Conway CGA. Call 416-544-9655 and get your business in gear.
Welcome back to Mental Health Matters with your host, Dr. Peter Sacco.
Welcome back to Matters of the Mind. The doc is online, and Todd Miller's online with me, my co-host. And, you know, Todd, this was kind of one of these, I guess, deep shows. You know, you can look at it in many ways. You can look at it as a political subject. You can look at it as a religious subject, a mental health subject, or just over a socially phenomenon. I guess pick your poison.
You know, you're right. It impacts in so many different ways. There's so many stressors and so many ways that it can start. But Pat was very eloquent in saying that, you know, substance abuse generally starts when there's stress at home or at work. Again, if you don't have a job and you're stressing about it and maybe your parents are giving you a hard time about, you know, you're not in school, you don't have a job, what are you doing with your life? Then one of the quick, not the right thing to do, but one of the quick ways to deal with it is to leave and be out on your own.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. And you know what's really interesting and where it gets disturbing, and even Pat talked about it, the amount of and we talked about the youth, the adolescents, and I know, going back to my own childhood, you know, every kid at one point said, I'm gonna run away from home, and your parents say, well, let's help you pack, let's see if you think the world's a better place out there for you. And you know, you make it down the street and before you know it, you're on your way back. Unfortunately, you know, we're talking, that was back in the day, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But then something came about in the 90s and definitely into the 2000s, where when kids, teenagers ran away, they actually meant business. They ran away. And unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of the repercussions of them. They're on the street. But the bottom line is they're on the streets for different reasons.
Yeah, there's no, you can't just, like we said, we talked about, there's no one definite issue that causes homelessness. It's all based on circumstances, you know, whether it's a one-parent family, whether it's low income, whether it's geographic area. I mean, there are so many different things. And as Pat said, there's going to be no ending it until the root causes, and she listed about six of them, are dealt with. And that really requires money. You need to throw money at it. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. And you know what? And the bottom line is, and several people who have emailed me leading up to this show, they brought it up. They said, you know what? This, Peter, was one of the worst winters we have ever seen in terms of not only snowfall, but also just the Arctic temperatures. And nobody should be on the streets. And some people wanted to know, where did these people wind up when this cold spell hit? We're talking like a 3-month cold spell. It was cold, that cold, that long. Where did they go? And some people are actually worried. They said, hopefully these people didn't freeze to death. And that is a major concern. And for those listening, I highly recommend and strongly recommend checking out websites like the greatnonprofits.org website that has homeless shelters as well as housing nonprofit organizations and charities. Not only if you know somebody that is homeless, because hopefully if you know somebody's homeless, you're doing your best to try to accommodate them or get them into the right assistance, but rather that you yourself can actually reach out and help either shelters for the homeless assistance programs, homeless housing, no-fee apartments, emergency shelters. And also they have organizations in Canada, definitely in the Toronto area, cheap apartments for rent.
By all means, there's so many resources, and we would hope that you wouldn't have to stay outdoors, that you would at least be able to get some temporary shelter. And there's a wealth of mental health professionals out there that are willing and able to help people, you know, get the help they need and move on in their lives.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring that point up, Todd, because sometimes the person that is homeless on the streets, and this, you know, this is a major concern. A lot of them have slipped through the cracks within the mental health service system, that some of them need to be medicated, especially if they have a disorder, you know, a psychotic mental problem, whether it be, you know, really bad schizophrenia, or they suffer from Korsakoff's disease, which basically is their brain is not functioning, or they have dementias. These are the people that really need help, and a lot of them cannot get the help themselves. So if you do see these folks out there, call the police, call 911 if you see them out there, especially if it's a cold night. You don't want somebody like that to freeze to death, because that is our fellow man, our fellow sisters. And that is, as Pat eloquently put it, that is somebody's daughter out there, somebody's mother, somebody's child.
Yeah. And trust me, it's tough love, but they will thank you later once you've hopefully saved their life.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those tuning in, thank you so much. And we've given you a lot to think about today. You know, it's one of these heart of the matter subjects. But thank you so much for tuning in to Matters of the Mind. And we will see you next time.
We'll see you next Wednesday at 8 p.m. Thanks for tuning in. If you can't keep You've been listening to Matters of the Mind on Listen Up Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Peter Andrew Sacco. Reach him on his website, petersacco.com, or you can reach him through Listen Up at talk-radio.ca. We really thank you for listening. Reach out to us on Facebook, facebook.com/listenuptalkradio, on Twitter at listenuptalk. We'll catch you next week. You don't need no care. That man is not your man, and that's why I'm